colonialism and the effects of the hurricane, both of which joined together and have ripped the clothes off of colonialism. The storms certainly have, and its devastation. Okay, I'm Mimi Rosenberg with
Carlito Rovira.
And we are saying stay strong, stay well, support WBAI, support the Puerto Rican struggle, and pledge now 212-209-2950 for equal rights and justice.
Que viva Puerto Rico libre.
Ah, indeed. Thank you for listening.
Años de historia forjando la patria nuestra, abriendo el surco y sembrando semillas de independencia. Nuestro pueblo está de pie y luchando con conciencia. Nuestro pueblo está de pie y luchando con conciencia.
Yo quiero que mi Borinque
llegando el momento de la decisión.
WBAI New York, coming up in a moment. Joy versus
el alma se llena. Nuestro pueblo canta y baila a ritmo de bomba y plena. Nuestro pueblo canta.
Joy of resistance. We have found the joy in resistance. Don't underestimate our persistence. Joy of resistance. We have found the joy in resistance. We got a way to go before we're free. We're keeping organized together. We have come a long distance. Joy, joy of resistance. Sisters of the joy of resistance. Government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
Good morning. This is the Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. We bring you news of what's happening around the world in the area of women's rights. And we look at the forces, the themes, and the history that underlie the constant push and pull that goes on in this area. I'm Fran Locke. And today we're going to be looking at 19th century concepts of women and motherhood that are embedded in the language of the latest abortion ban, which has become law in West Virginia. And then we're going to go to a recent interview with Professor Peggy Cooper Davis, a law professor at NYU, who contends that a much better basis for legalizing abortion than Roe versus Wade used would be the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that were introduced after the Civil War to create more freedom and equality for formerly enslaved African people. Before we get into the program, I have one news story. It is on the massive protests led by women in Iran that have been going on for 5 days. The sounds you are hearing are the sounds of massive protests that have been taking place in Iran throughout the last 5 days, sparked by the death at the hands of the morality police of a 22-year-old woman, Mahsa Amini, who was arrested for not wearing her hijab properly. Large groups of women have publicly thrown their hijabs into bonfires and also publicly cut their hair as part of the mass protest. There has been a huge response by Iranian state police, with the government claiming 6 deaths and Amnesty International saying it is closer to 320. Hijabs, head coverings that must completely cover a woman's hair, have been mandatory for women in Iran since the so-called Revolution of 1979, when religious elements in the coalition that overthrew the Shah after the victory kicked out their leftist coalition members, subjecting many to imprisonment and torture. Among other religiously imposed laws initiated at that time was mandatory hijab for women. After the revolution, upwards of 70,000 women marched to protest involuntary hijab, but were met with violence from gangs of boys from religious schools believed organized by the government, who beat the demonstrating women with sticks. Since then, the morality police have enforced compliance with threats of beatings and imprisonment. Throughout, there have been periodic upsurges of protest, including in 2009, when many women also took off their hijabs publicly and threw them into fires. The UN High Commission is currently initiating an inquiry into the death of Mahsa Amini. The government, threatened by the massive protests, has insisted Amini had a pre-existing heart condition, but her family says she did not, and CT scans reveal massive hemorrhaging in her brain and evidence of many blows to her head. Protests rocking Iran are showing no signs of abating. And in this country, we are continuing to reel from the repercussions of the extreme far-right move by the Supreme Court of the United States that was stacked by the Trump administration with far-right conservatives who proceeded to fulfill their long-time plan to overturn a settled right, the right to legalized abortion. In these days, almost 3 months since that decision, the results are still in freefall, with 14 states having passed draconian abortion bans and a little bit more than that number of states having moved to protect abortion rights, and the rest of the states in limbo, with bans being overturned and then reinstated and then overturned again almost on a daily basis. One thing is certain. The far right, now seeing itself in the ascendancy, is flexing its muscles and showing more of its true colors each and every day. One example, not content with his former position to, quote, let abortion be legislated by each state, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham last week introduced a bill proposing a federal, that is, a nationwide ban on abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Roe, of course, mandated 24 weeks, or what is estimated as viability, the time a fetus could survive outside the womb. But under his bill, any state would be free to have more extreme local laws. So the reform would only be in one direction, downwards. Of course, the state stepping in to dictate to a woman what she may do to her own body at any stage of pregnancy is tantamount to a woman losing her constitutional rights to her own body when she becomes pregnant. That's from the party that stresses individual freedom. Yeah. But that is the crux of the matter. Who owns a woman's body anyway? Her husband? The church? The government? Feminists say that a woman owns her own body. Given the major battles fought over this for centuries, the stakes must be pretty high. We get some pretty strong clues as to the right-wing vision of how women should live our lives and what the nature of our existence should be in a very chilling piece of legislation that has just passed the West Virginia legislature. It is the latest abortion ban. It is House Resolution 302, and it was introduced on September 13th, and it says, providing for a statement of the sentiments of the House of Delegates upon the passage of HB 302, West Virginia's law governing abortion. And I'm going to read it to you. Here we go. Whereas, through Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the Supreme Court of the United States effectively granted every American woman a constitutional right to abortion, which individual states could restrict or expand but never eliminate entirely. And whereas the Supreme Court has overturned these decisions as attempts to legislate through the judicial power, has declared itself ignorant as to the moral character of the act of abortion, and has returned the question of abortion to the states and their elected representatives. And whereas West Virginians have historically rejected the status of abortion as a, quote, right, unquote, which rejection has been most recently and explicitly confirmed in 2018 with the electorate passing an amendment to the state constitution specifically denying that the state constitution recognizes a right to abortion. Therefore, be it resolved by the House of Delegates that this legislation reaffirms West Virginia's historic rejection of abortion as an act ill-fitting for a peaceful and virtuous people, as a society in which abortion is a right is one which devalues the source of its own existence, its mothers and their children. And be it further resolved that the maintenance of a peaceful and prosperous society depends upon the subordination of power and interest to the well-being of mothers, as their bearing and rearing of children determines the existence and quality of our common life together with infinitely greater efficacy than any federal or state policy. And be it further resolved that we are cognizant that as an institution, motherhood is prior to the state, and as such, the state must work to serve mothers and their interests, as the health of any state can be determined in the main by their health and happiness. And be it further resolved that the now defunct legal opinion that mothers must be able to abort their children regardless of what a state's people have historically believed and legislated regarding the question inverted this common sense, and be it further resolved that rather than protecting the very source of our common life, the overreach of the court allowed powerful interests to devalue motherhood into a mere option without privilege or special importance, and be it further resolved that the previous decisions of the United States Supreme Court effectively empowered those who would describe motherhood as merely a fungible good that could and should be sacrificed to their own interests, including, most obviously, the interests of those private entities which rely on the labor of women and find their capacity to become mothers detrimental to their goals, the interests of those who directly profit from the procurement of abortion, and the interests of those men who would enjoy women merely as sexual partners without becoming partners in their sacrifice as mothers, and be it. And I'm going to stop for 1 minute to review that paragraph. In the paragraph above, they're trying to say that they're a specific group of villains, and they're trying to talk about who they are, that are responsible for abortion ever having been legalized in the first place. Here's who these villains are. Quote, private entities who want to employ women and find their capacity to become mothers detrimental to their goals, close quote, and who, quote, directly profit from abortion. So who are those supposed to be? Doctors? Clinics? And they go on to point out those men who would enjoy women merely as sexual partners without becoming partners in their sacrifice as mothers. So, they go on, therefore be it further resolved that such radical individualism is inconsistent with West Virginia's tradition of honoring those vocations which contribute more directly and more fundamentally to the common good than do others, such as emergency responders and members of the armed services. And be it further resolved that the state, therefore, ought to treat mothers accordingly with their sacrifices. Now, I'm going to stop there for a minute and just say, that's a good one. If you want to treat mothers accordingly with their sacrifices, how about some paid parental leave? How about affordable child care so that mothers could get a break and earn their own income? Maybe be able to have the money to move out of an abusive situation? Or how about more child tax credits, such as the ones last year that lifted 1 million children out of poverty, but then were discontinued, plunging those families back into poverty? How about a healthcare system that doesn't place the U.S. as one of the worst for infant mortality? How about a guaranteed minimum income for all families, along with affordable housing? Do you think that mothers might prefer that to the prison-like pedestal you are constructing in this legislation? That's my comment. They go on. And be it further resolved that among these are that mothers are obliged to care for their children, that all decent governments must recognize and enforce this obligation alongside the obligation of fathers, and that parents must provide for the health, safety, education, and emotional well-being of their children, to which I say, see above paragraph about what parents actually need to raise families and keep them out of poverty, all right? Anyway, and so they go on further resolving that she has the right to this care and solicitude which empowers her in her ability to care for her children. And at the least, this right demands that the state protect her from powerful interests that would pressure her through threats or promises to reject her elevated position and return her to the ranks of, quote, normal, unquote, citizens. All right. I'm going to repeat the paragraph above. So let me say that once more. And be it further resolved that she has a right to this care and solicitude, which empowers her in her ability to care for her children. And at the least, this right demands that the state protect her from powerful interests that would pressure her through threats or promises to reject her elevated position and return her to the ranks of, quote, normal, unquote, citizens. And I'm going to interpret the paragraph above. We women cannot think for ourselves. Our poor little brains are at the mercy of pressures from unprincipled industries and yes men. And now the state of West Virginia will protect us from all of that by taking away our rights to decide for ourselves. If we want to embark on this major undertaking of motherhood, which the state itself in this law describes as a sacrifice on the level with being in the armed forces or being an emergency medical worker. Okay, the law goes on. Further resolved that society's obligation goes beyond such minimal protections offered by the state, and be it further resolved that society must positively serve mothers in their most profound and important vocation, and be it further resolved that West Virginia's historic rejection of abortion implicitly recognizes the obligation of a mother to her unborn child, and in doing so, it harmonizes with the pre-Roe mores and social norms which did and still do characterize the people of West Virginia, who do not countenance the neglect of children at any stage of life. Okay, and be it further resolved, I'm going to skip a couple of these. They go on to state that women should never have to make such a hard bargain, and that those persons act detrimentally to fundamental social morals who present motherhood as an obstacle to an otherwise happy life. And I'm going to comment there. You would think from the above that someone is forcing women to have abortions, and that us poor damsels need to be rescued from these evil forces. And yet they then further resolve that just governments have long asserted that they have the duty to protect women from those who would use their relative power in order to, quote, convince, unquote, them to perform acts against their conscience. And they further resolve that by returning to a historic rejection of abortion, this legislature recognized that this duty extends to motherhood. And my comment is that so the government has a duty to protect women from themselves. Yeah. And be it further resolved that it takes up the power of the law for the sake of mothers who do not normally want abortion, and against those who would use their power and influence to make motherhood seem untenable, their power and influence to make motherhood seem untenable rather than make abortion seem unnecessary. And they then further resolved that the criminalization of abortion must be only the beginning of West Virginia's post-Roe initiatives. And they even further resolved that we must turn now to positive protection and flourishing of mothers as a return to the most fundamental reasons for the existence of government. And finally, they further resolve that West Virginians are a moral and decent people. We must now accept the legislative challenge that this decency demands. Okay. All right. So that is the law. I hope you were able to get through that with me. And that is the law in West Virginia now. Well, of course, there were outrage statements by Planned Parenthood and lots of comparisons in media coverage to Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, a work of speculative fiction in which the bearers of children become the most powerless people in society, passed from one upper-class man to another to be impregnated by him and bear his children, while at the same time being sold a bill of goods as to the great services they are providing to society. Well, I don't think you have to go to fiction to find an example of the saintliness of motherhood being used to deny women their rights as persons. You need only look in U.S. history to the long, excruciating 75-year battle of women to get the vote. Why do you think that battle lasted so long? I am now going to play for you a dramatic reading of an all-too-real statement that was issued by a group of, quote, concerned men, unquote, during that long battle for the vote, talking about the special place of women and mothers that would be supposedly forever tarnished should women actually get to have any power in the real world. Here it is, introduced by Pawnee Sills and read by Bobby Higer as part of the documentary play, Promise and Betrayal, Voices from the Struggle for Women's Emancipation, 1776 to 1920 by Carol Hainish. Please keep in mind when you hear this that you are listening to an actual statement that was widely distributed as the fight for the vote heated up. This is not a fictional statement by the playwright.
Throughout the struggle for women's rights, feminists have been met with opposition by both individual men and well-organized institutional forces. In 1914, an hysterical white male manifesto typical of the business interests arrayed against female suffrage was issued in Nebraska. It was signed by 29 capitalists, all white men, including representatives of railroads, banks, grain elevators, utilities, retail stores, plus several lawyers and national politicians, and two Episcopalia ministers.
To the men of the state of Nebraska, we yield to none in our admiration, veneration, and respect for woman. We recognize in her admirable and adorable qualities and sweet and noble influences which make for the betterment of mankind and the advancement of civilization. We have ever been willing and ready to grant to woman every right and protection, even to favoritism in the law. We would take from woman none of their privileges as citizens, but we do not believe that women are adapted to the political work of the world. Open the terrible page of the French Revolution and the days of terror. Who led those bloodthirsty mobs? Who shrieked loudest in that hurricane of passion? Woman! Her picture upon the page of history is indelible. There are spheres in which feeling should be paramount. There are kingdoms in which the heart should reign supreme. That kingdom belongs to woman. The realm of sentiment, the realm of love, the realm of gentler and holier and kindlier attributes that make the name of wife, mother, and sister next to the name of God himself. But it is not in harmony with suffrage and has no place in government.
So, was the statement justifying the West Virginia abortion ban not an echo of the Victorian sentimentality that catered to women's, quote, special role that was used then as now to stop women from getting actual legal rights, i.e. to keep men in power and continue to disempower women? Can they really keep trotting out this crap in 2022? This is what's happening, folks. And we wish it was just an amusing joke, but every day women and girls are thrown more into chaos as they try to control their lives and their bodies without access to the right to not be pregnant. One more thing. You'll notice that the West Virginia statement says a number of times that, quote, women do not really want abortions. Well, powerful groups of men claiming to speak for what women really want was also a constant ploy in the battle for the vote. Here's a song written by author Charlotte Perkins Gilman in 1898 that points with bitter irony to the fact that this, quote, argument had worn thin even then. It's called The Women Do Not Want It. It's sung by Bev Grant with a melody by Carol Hainish and Bev Grant.
When the woman's suffrage argument first stood upon its legs, they answered it with cabbages, they answered it with eggs. They answered it with ridicule, they answered it with scorn. They thought it a monstrosity that should not have been born. When the woman suffrage argument grew vigorous and wise, and was not to be answered by these opposite replies, they turned their opposition into reasoning severe upon the limitations of our God-appointed sphere. We were told of disabilities, a long array of these, till one could think that womanhood was merely a disease, and the maternal sacrifice was added to the plan of the various sacrifices we have always made to man. Religionists and scientists in amity and bliss, however else they disagreed, could all agree on this. And the gist of all their discourse when you got down in it was, we could not have the ballot because we were not fit. You may talk of suffrage now with an educated man, and he agrees with all you say as sweetly as he can. 'Twould be better for us all, of course, if womanhood was free, but the women do not want it, and so it must not be. 'Tis such a tender thoughtfulness, so exquisite a care, not to pile on our frail shoulders what we do not wish to bear. But, O most generous brother, let us look a little more. Have we women always wanted what you gave to us before? Did we ask for veils and harems and painful corset laces? Did we beseech to be unclean, shut out of sacred places? Did we beg for scolding bridles and dunking stools to come and clamor for the beating stick no thicker than your thumb? Did we ask to be forbidden from all the trades that pay? Did we claim the lower wages for a man's full work today? Have we petitioned for the laws wherein our shame is shown, that not a woman's child nor her body is her own? What women want has never been a strongly acted cause. When women has been wronged by man in churches, customs, laws, why should we find this preference so largely in his way, when he himself admits the right of what we ask today?
And you've just heard a detailed report of a new law in West Virginia that bans abortion with narrow exceptions. And that law is outstanding because it has within it a very long statement claiming the abortion ban is in the service of women and mothers. At the same time, we cannot forget that the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, a right-wing Democrat, recently made sure that no poor mothers could lift their families out of poverty when he nixed the child tax credit, which had lifted a million children out of poverty in 2021, but has not been extended. So they take away real support for mothers. At the same time, they indulge in fake veneration of motherhood and give a lot of platitudes. And you are listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in the tri-state area and streaming worldwide at WBAI.org. My name is Fran Luck. The program is Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. WBAI is entirely listener-supported. That means the only reason it is here is because people like you support it financially. And we are asking you to dig deep and to support us at this time. You can do that by calling 212-209-2950 and saying you'd like to become a sustaining member. A sustaining member sends a regular contribution to WBAI. It could be as little as $10 or $15 a month. You probably will hardly miss it. In the meantime, it will keep this station going and keep bringing you the fantastic array of programming that you hear every day and that you will not hear anywhere else. And that is, again, because we are listener-supported, we take no corporate support, so we are not beholden to any sponsors. and we can tell you the truth as we see it. You can also go to give to the number 2, WBAI.org, and become a sustaining member or make a one-time contribution in the name of your favorite show. That might even be Joy of Resistance, that weekly brings you coverage of the worldwide struggles of women, coverage that you will not hear on any other radio station. We are now going to listen to a replay of an interview I did in July with Professor Peggy Cooper Davis, which she talks about why abortion rights should be grounded in the Reconstruction Amendment, amendments passed after the Civil War to free formerly enslaved people.
Now the president and all his men dare try to say when I might or when I may make the decision.
Peggy Cooper Davis on the line. Are you there, Professor Davis?
I am here. Good morning.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you, and I'm very glad our call went through. Good morning. Let me introduce you. Professor Peggy Cooper Davis is a professor, a law professor at NYU. She is the Shad Professor of Lawyering and Ethics. She joined the NYU Law Faculty in 1983 after having served as a judge for 3 years in the New York State Family Court. She has published 2 books, more than 50 articles. One of her specialties is cross-racial interactions in the legal system. And she has been writing lately, particularly an article in The Economist that brought me to get in touch with her, called Overturning Abortion Rights Ignores Freedoms Awarded After Slavery's End. So once again, good morning and welcome, Professor Cooper Davis.
Thank you.
And you're very welcome. And so let's get right into it. You argue in this wonderful article in The Economist, which I urge everybody to read, that constitutional amendments passed after the Civil War to guarantee freedom to formerly enslaved people also enshrined reproductive rights. Well, this is a very unique theory, and I believe a very important one. So let's follow your article. You begin by talking about the U.S. Constitution's vagueness in regard to personal rights. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. Let me ask you, to what do you attribute that vagueness and those holes that then needed very much to be filled?
Well, I want to start by observing that most constitutions in democracies around the world now have very clear statements of rights, and most of them include provisions that are easily interpreted as covering family autonomy and personal autonomy. Our Constitution doesn't have that. Initially, it had no Bill of Rights. There was complaint about that, and a Bill of Rights was added subsequently, quickly, but it only applied to the federal government. It was a Bill of Rights that only restrained the federal government. It didn't restrain the states or individuals. Now, one might ask, why wasn't there a general Bill of Rights as there is in most democracies? My thesis is that one of the important reasons for that was that you couldn't have a general statement of human rights and at the same time have slavery.
Mm-hmm.
If people had a right to personal autonomy, to family autonomy, a right to form families at all, or other basic rights, then people couldn't be enslaved.
Right.
So I am arguing that, and I'm not certainly the only one, many historians have said, that the absence of clear statements of rights in our Constitution had to do with the preservation of slavery. It had to do with the compromise between the non-slaveholding states and the slaveholding states over that issue.
Right. And I want to say that when I read your article, a light bulb went off in my head because, you know, I had never made that exact connection. And it's a stunningly important connection in terms of how our whole jurisprudence apparatus in the United States developed. So thank you just for that. But yes, but then you go on and you talk about the Bill of Rights. As you say, it only dealt with infringements by the federal government, not by individuals or, you know, or individual states. And since we are looking in this development for legalities that will affect our reproductive rights, you talk a lot about where reproductive rights, and that is, of course, you know, ironic because there were none, for enslaved people were at, because you feel that there's a connection to the laws that freed enslaved people in the United States, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Maybe you can draw that together. What are those connections between the situation of enslaved people under slavery and the later amendments, and why you feel that reproductive rights are actually situated in those amendments, the basis for reproductive rights?
Sure. It's a little complicated, but I think straightforward once you piece it together. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War can be understood, and I think should be understood, as anti-slavery amendments. I've said already that they undid, or they cured the flaw in the Constitution, in that there was no human rights constraint upon states or individuals. But when I went to look at the debates of those amendments, and also the debates of civil rights legislation that was being passed right after the Civil War, I saw repeatedly that members of Congress were talking about what the effect of these amendments would be, what the post-Reconstruction world would look like. And time again, they said, it will be, in effect, the opposite of slavery. Mm-hmm. One congressperson said, slavery cannot have a home. With this legislation, everyone can have a home. One could not have a recognized and secure attachment to a spouse. When these amendments are passed, that will end. One could not have control of one's children. When these amendments are passed, that will end. And another thing that was mentioned that comes closest to the argument about abortion rights is that there were many references to the practice of breeding slaves, mm-hmm. That enslaved people forced into sexual encounters in order to increase the stock of a slave owner. And so this, too, was going to end, this control over people's reproductive lives and this control over one's progeny in addition to oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we can understand from that is that there was an effort to describe freedom. And freedom was described repeatedly in contrast to slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And the absence of family rights had to be ended.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I really hear where you are going. It is such a well-reasoned argument and a very moving argument. In your article in The Economist, you talk about the resistances that took place under the slave system to the complete control of their reproductive capacity by the state holders, that is, the resistances by the enslaved people while they were enslaved. And can you talk about some of those resistances to that reproductive tyranny that happened during the period of enslavement?
Yes, as I was initially doing my research on this matter, I found just all kinds of shocking stories. These were things that had been uncovered by historians in the past, but these connections hadn't been made. But doctors who were interviewed who had treated enslaved people when they got medical treatment, frequently reported that they had discovered that women had used a number of devices to try to prevent conception. Sometimes they were herbs, sometimes they were physical devices, but it was clear that people were trying not to produce children who would be immediately enslaved, mm-hmm. and whom they could not claim as family members. And, of course, the shattering and shocking incidents are incidents in which women killed their children and killed themselves,
mm-hmm.
in order to escape themselves from slavery and in order to prevent their children being, their infants being enslaved. Now, I have to rush to say that I'm not arguing that there's a right to infanticide. There comes a point where intervention is appropriate. But I think that when you imagine an enslaved woman who has perhaps been forced to have sex with someone for breeding purposes rather than because she had an affectionate relationship with that person, does not want to be pregnant, does whatever she can to avoid becoming pregnant, and does that, of course, as an enslaved woman, at great risk of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine, I mean, Toni Morrison helped us imagine in The Blooded, the desperation of someone who would turn to suicide and to the murder of their children,
yes.
to keep them out of slavery.
Right. So thank you for that. The right to not procreate under conditions of slavery was being manifested, or shall we say, fought for or resisted toward during slavery. And
yes.
you therefore take it to the different amendments under Reconstruction, which were meant to ameliorate all of that. And you talk particularly about the 14th Amendment, and I'd like to go to some of the language of the 14th Amendment that you invoke, because you are saying, I believe, that that language would really be a better basis for the reproductive right, for reproductive rights legally in the United States, than the one that we currently use, which is kind of a little, it's called the shadow or penumbra implications of a number of parts of the Bill of Rights, etc., and some of the 14th Amendment. But talk about the 14th Amendment and why it undergirds reproductive rights.
Well, the 14th Amendment, of course, did some very important things that are consistent with the effort to assure that conditions like slavery could no longer exist in the United States. And one of them was to overrule a Supreme Court case pre-Civil War that had held that African Americans were not citizens. So one of the first things that you find in the 14th Amendment is a definition of citizenship, which did not exist in the original Constitution. The original Constitution did not say who was a citizen of the United States. So this is where you find the language that if you were born or naturalized in the United States, you were a citizen of the United States. So the first thing I argue is that by being a citizen, you incur a bundle of rights that is to be defined. The second thing the 14th Amendment says is that you cannot be denied the privileges and immunities of a citizenship. And again, what the privileges and immunities of citizenship are is to be defined, but all of these family rights that I have talked about were privileges and immunities of citizenship. The drafters of the Reconstruction Amendments went further, and they said that no person will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, it is that clause, known as the Due Process Clause, that I argue is the sounder basis for reproductive rights, because one is being denied liberty, and one is being denied liberty without appropriate justification. And the due process of law language has been interpreted so that it means, not only does it mean that whenever the government does something to you, they have to follow appropriate procedures, but it means that some things that the government might do to you are so extreme and so much in violation of your rights as a human being and a citizen, that the strictest scrutiny has to be given to that action. And it is currently under this idea that the Due Process Clause protects liberty in a substantive way, that the right of abortion choice is, I think, most soundly protected.
Yes. Wow. What a chain of reasoning. We are just about at the end of our discussion, and what I wanted to end with is what you write at the end of your article, which is in The Economist, and I'll give the title of that in a moment. You say, It is consistent with the anti-slavery spirit of the Reconstruction Amendments that people under the jurisdiction of a reconstructed United States hold the right to choose whether and when they will reproduce. The spirit of the Reconstruction Amendments. And yes, it's a wonderful conclusion. And I don't know where we're going as a country from here on reproductive rights, but I think this kind of examination and the multiple ways in which reproductive rights are justified, if it need any justification, is so, what you've contributed is so important to that understanding and the understanding of the actual history of the United States. So I want to thank you very, very much, Professor Peggy Cooper Davis, whom we've been speaking with. And the name of your article is Overturning Abortion Rights Ignores Freedom Awarded After Freedoms Rather Awarded After Slavery's End. It has been just great speaking with you, and I look forward to seeing more of your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. So that was an interview I was very much looking forward to. And once again, thank you to Professor Peggy Cooper Davis coming to Joy of Resistance on relatively short notice to have that amazing discussion. Well, that's it for today's episode of Joy of Resistance. If you'd like to respond to anything you heard in this broadcast, please get in touch with us by emailing us at jor@wbai.org. That's J-O-R, which stands for Joy of Resistance, at wbai.org. And we will answer you. Very, very happy to hear what our listeners have to say. You can also follow us on Twitter at Joy of Resistance. And you will get announcements of our shows and other feminist commentary. And Joy of Resistance will not be on next week, and possibly not the week after, due to that pesky transmitter fixing that seems to be happening more and more often. But we will certainly be back in October, bringing you more cutting-edge programming from the front lines of the struggles of women throughout the world. Thank you so much. Take care.
Working hard out of my days for finer things in life. Happy life than one peaceful night. When I went out for a walk, a hand around my mouth, an intruder to the colors of my womb. I was young and did not understand the facts of life. Broken home, love was rare and life a fight. Then I came across a young boy who would hold me tight and leave me lonely with the colors from my womb. Sometimes he could not tell the difference between night and day. Intoxicated days had rearranged his way. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day from my mother to the colors of my womb. Men dare try to say when I might or when I may make the decisions that they set me up for anyway. Insult my mind, my rights, the issues of my womb.
Colors of My Womb, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on WBAI in New York.